I love living independently at home, but sometimes I need a little help. That's when it's nice to know that I have an angel by my side.
It won't last, it won't last. You'll get old and you'll get fat, filled with parasites from your cat, stinky cream upon your back. Look at Johnny Rotten, all you cool kids in despair. He still has orange hair, but now he looks like Cher. It won't last, it won't last. You'll get old and you'll get fat, filled with parasites from your cat, menthol cream upon your back.
If I could turn back time,
rheumatoid arthritis, plan up for shyness, 7 shits a day cause you're ulcerative colitis. Can't cure cancer with a record collection, backstage passes won't cure your infection. So you play the guitar, travel real far, anesthesiologists don't care who you are. Your cardiac surgeon doesn't care who you are. The coroner doesn't care who you are. Who you were.
Once you raged against the machine, now you need a breathing machine or you'll have a heart attack while you shop at Nordstrom Rack. You'll retweet musty memes saying kids have sold their soul. You'll clench the remote control as you die on the toilet bowl. It won't last, it won't last. You'll get old, you'll get fat, your face chewed on by your cat, no one wondering where you're at. Your landlord will come knocking when they complain about the stink. Your cat will get adopted, your clothes out on the street. It won't last, it won't last. You'll reincarnate as a bat, try to be kind instead of cool while you're still in human school.
Visiting angels, America's choice in home care.
Greetings, friends. That was Candy's Ladies Feet Friends, and that's a track off their new LP, Blaster. You can find that on Spindler, and I think it's streaming for free on Krexel. Welcome. Today we have a wonderful podcast with David Nickturn. Before we jump into that, I want to invite you, if you happen to be in the North Carolina area, to come and see me and William Montgomery. We're going to be at Good Nights in Raleigh. Then the next week, coming right up, going to be at Helium in Portland. These shows are about to sell out, so get your tickets in advance, please. It makes me feel good. It's comforting. It feeds my ego, and it bloats me out like an old bloated ego fly. What a show we have for you. Oh, shit. One last plug. I forgot. Patreon.com/DTFH. Head there for commercial free episodes of this glorious podcast, won't you? Also, we hang out generally once a week. We have a meditation and what we call a family gathering. It's just yapping. Our community makes the folks at Spawn Ranch look like assholes. All right, friends, here we go. David Nickturn is an author. He runs a wonderful foundation called Dharma Moon. He's also my meditation teacher. And of course, he's David from the Midnight Gospel. And on Tuesday, May 9th, David and I are going to have a free live online discussion about artificial intelligence, Buddhism, and the future of mindfulness. That's May 9th. I hope that you will sign up. We're also going to talk about his Dharma Moon meditation teacher training beginning in June 2023. All the links you need to find that will be at duncantrussell.com. Also, if you like David, you can join him and Eve Lewis Prieto, the main voice and teacher on the Headspace app, for the start of a special four-week online course on the foundations of mindfulness. Again, all those links at duncantrussell.com. Now let's dive in. Welcome, David Nickturn. My editor, Aaron's out of town, so I don't have the theme song. Welcome. Welcome, all of you. Welcome to you. It's the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Welcome back, David. It's so great to see you. I've been looking forward to our conversation all day. How you doing?
I'm very happy right now.
All right. Congratulations.
I don't know why, but that's just, when you asked me, I thought I'm going to check right this moment how I am. You know, not tell you like how I've been for the last days or weeks or anything like that. So
that's
right now,
amazing.
I feel really good. Of course, it's great to see you. That always brings me joy.
Great to see you. Now, as a Buddhist teacher, as a teacher of meditation, Do you think you could quantify happiness to unhappiness in your life? Like, what percentage of happiness versus what percentage of unhappiness?
Well, a Buddhist teacher who does not talk about suffering is not worth their salt. So All this happiness this, happiness that. To me, the big topics are suffering and freedom from suffering. That's like right to the Four Noble Truths there. And that's the first time out of the barn with the Buddha mind. You know, happiness is could be pretty relative, don't you think?
Yeah, like, can you, like, give an example of a combo suffering, happiness, state of consciousness?
It easily comes to mind. Like, relative happiness is like you have a nice bowl of soup that was in the fridge, but it was in the fridge for too long. So while you're eating it, you're happy. And right after you feel happy, and 3 hours later, you don't feel so happy. It's so easy to make us happy and take our happiness away that it's almost you wonder why we'd invest so much time in it.
So this brings me to something I've been thinking about, which is life is process, looking at life as a process versus like framing it as this is exactly what's happening. So if you could get your third eye a little bit above the time-space continuum so that instead of seeing like just what's happening right now, but look at the future and the way you have memories, then you what you're talking about would become crystal clear, which is that yes, right now you're happy or you're unhappy right now, but you would recognize this is leading to potentially the polar opposite condition. But we can't do that. We're in the present moment, so it's easy to trick yourself into thinking, I'm going to feel great about this soup for the rest of the night.
Well, that's why I like that, you know, to me this has all been iterated kind of perfectly already, so not to put anybody off like thinking that there's somebody kind of clearly stated what's going on, but the four kinds of suffering, you know, you know, one is not getting what you want. Two is getting what you don't want. It's already good, right?
Yeah.
Three is alternation, the pain of alternation between getting what you want and not getting what you want. That in itself is painful. And the fourth one is all-pervasive suffering, which is just the undertone of kind of like, even in the most peak moments, even in the worst moments, it's just a sort of general sense of dissatisfaction or things
not
being
kind
of synchronized.
You just described Las Vegas. That is
well, that's what I was trying to do.
I've never heard a more perfect description of Las Vegas in my entire life. Yeah, the alternation, you're getting what you want, then you're not, then you are, but the whole thing sucks. When you really like take a moment, look around Las Vegas at all the people who came there ready to experience the peak of their lives, and it's a scam, a fraud. So underneath all the drunken revelry, there's that pure suffering of suffering. Then you see, the last time I went there, a guy at a slot machine next to me hits the machine and yells out, "I worked so hard for that money." And you're just like, what the fuck did you think was going to happen? You're playing Wizard of Oz slots with like money that you care about? But still in that moment, he was fully like in the alternation because truly like 20 minutes before his friends were around, they're cheering. They're like, yes. The look in his eye is like, oh my God, my life's about to change for the better.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the you know what the real meaning of Las Vegas is, right? You know the translation or not?
No.
It translates roughly to something like this. Obviously samsaric. Clearly samsaric.
Right.
And like, for which you could kind of dig it in a way. You go like, okay, this is really a chance to blow the whole thing up to the point where you're seeing the engine of the beast in a way.
Yes.
But it's no worse than any other place. It's the same, basically. It's just on high. It's just on high alert. You know, high relief. I don't mind it there at all, personally. Do you? You like it?
Well, once I learned what you just said, once I learned, like I would go there with this idiot mentality of like resisting Las Vegas. Like, I don't gamble. It's like, well, what the? Why did you come for the shows? You want to see Cirque du Soleil? Well, I don't really enjoy strip clubs. Oh, really? So you're in Las Vegas. You know, it's like saying you don't like baguettes in Paris or something like that. So
yes.
Once I realized you just completely surrender to the samsara, yeah. Throw yourself in completely, decadence, insanity, madness, within reason, then it can
be
a really
just outlined,
place.
Duncan, you just outlined the two extremes, you know, right?
You mean Paris and Las Vegas?
No, Las Vegas, I love it. I'm in it. I dive all the way in, and I'm not, I don't gamble. I don't get it. I don't like it here. So all you have outlined the kind of the gutters and the bowling alley of experience. Now, in between there's experience unfolding in real time that probably is as worth noting there as it would be anywhere else, because the art is not getting in the right situation. The art is perfecting the art of awareness, right? Isn't that what we're sort of tuning into?
Yes, sure.
Whichever of the six realms you're in, the key is awareness, right?
Right. Now, but, you know, can you – let's talk about awareness in detail in the sense that, like – when I in the past initially you hear awareness and you feel like and I imagine it does mean this, you feel like it means a kind of like tuning into specific components of your reality, phenomena, like tuning into sort of the pixels of phenomena around you. Is that what you mean by awareness?
Wow, that's kind of a pointillist approach. You know, I'm sure you know, some of the impressionist painters would be very happy that you said that.
Yeah.
Pixels of awareness, right? Yeah. So, and well, that raises a really interesting question. Is awareness digital or analog? Is it a high resolution digital experience, or is it a flowing fluid experience? I think that takes us right back to what you were texting me about earlier, which is continuity and discontinuity. So is awareness continuous or discontinuous?
You know, I'm going to say that it's discontinuous in the way rivers are above ground and underground. That because you're not seeing the river doesn't mean it's not there. Or because, you know, like, for example, it's tragic in California. All these people, because of climate change, they built all these farms. They built all these structures in a dried up lake bed. But the snows came, the rains came. Now it's turning back into a lake, and they're fucked because they built in a lake bed and roads and like things that just they thought, well, this lake bed is never returning, even though it's a lake bed, the water will never come back. So you know what your question reminds me of that it's you know, awareness, the unawareness being the opposite of that, or that, you know, you lose your keys. Where was I when I lost my keys? Did I exist at all? Mm-hmm. Versus coming back and experiencing the moment as fully as you can.
Well, I think we train, you know, like the way you and I are training with meditation type of practices is to train in digital awareness, meaning just you want to be as focused and clear as you can about one moment of iteration of the experience of consciousness, right? You want to just be right there with it as it bubbles up to the surface, and they call it now. And then you relax, and then you catch the next one, so that you're constantly developing a muscle of coming back into the present.
Yes. Yes.
Is that what your practice is like? That's sort of what mine is like. I keep coming back.
Yes, but there definitely seems to be a pattern within that, which is that the first, just the recognition of what that even means, you know, you don't even know if you're doing it or experiencing it or if this is it at first. You get hit with it, and it's like, this seems like something, and then if you're my dumbass, you're like, shit, I just got enlightened, baby. This is great. I'm enlightened. And then it just goes away. The lake dries up, nothing's there. You're back to the thing that you were before. So it's like it's almost like a little crack appears or something. A little light pops in into a cave in or something, and you're like, shit, is that what I think it is? And then it's gone. And then you start recognizing that as something consistent. At least that's that's been my experience, and I'm fully prepared to be, and probably am wrong.
Well, tell me if this reminds you of what you're saying in any way. So it's a short anecdote. This guy is rehearsing for a play, right? And he has one line. Big actor, you know, one line the whole play.
Okay.
And what happens is that when the cannons are fired in the play, his line is, "Hark, I hear the cannons roar." That's his one line for the whole play. Okay. So, of course, he takes it very seriously, as one would. And then they're having rehearsal after rehearsal, and he's rehearsing at home. He's walking around, "Hark, I hear the cannons roar," and he's trying with different accents and different flavors. And, of course, then they don't actually fire the cannon off in rehearsals because it would be, you know, wasting bullets, so to speak.
Sure.
And now he's in the actual first performance of it after the dress rehearsal and all the rehearsals, and they actually fire the cannon off, and it's so loud. And he says,
right,
"What the fuck was that?" So is that like practice?
Yeah. Yes.
I think practice is more like that in a way.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that to me, that's like the big, that's the double-edged sword of, as far as I could tell, all spiritual techniques, is that it gives you an idea. You think you know what cannons are going to sound like, so you're always looking for that. And then the natural cannon fire, whatever, fill in the blank, whatever you want it to be, it can't be, if you've never heard a cannon, doesn't matter how good you are at imagining or extrapolating or picturing. Well, I know what a loud noise is. You will never be able to perfectly replicate a cannon. So that can become very confusing for people because you're always looking for extrinsic affirmation,
right,
of this very personal, very natural state. And that's where you get lost. That's where people get railroaded and hornswoggled because they find somebody who they think will affirm an intrinsic state.
Yeah, and you'll follow anybody if you're that confused.
Absolutely.
It's like being lost in the desert. You go like, "Oh, this person says there's water over there." You know, it's kind of the situation that we're in, partly. Would you agree? It's sort of where we find ourselves as the curtain goes up a little bit?
What do you mean?
A little bit bewildered. Well, what's going on? What's not going on?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a natural, a very natural way to be. I mean, it makes sense. Look at how bewildering. Everything is designed to bewilder. It's
right.
Depending on your definition of bewilderment, I mean, you know, the word for it is misinformation these days. That's the new word for Maya. Misinformation. We've got to protect everyone from misinformation. Label shit that this is misinformation and that person's deceptive and this person's deceptive. Deceptive algorithm. And it is. They're not wrong, but they're missing the root of the issue, which is like pretty much is everything, if you are fixated on it as being a constant, is misinformation. It's bewildering. And anything telling you this is a constant is misinforming you. Like to finish the point, I love car commercials because they are the most incredibly manipulative things you've ever seen in your life. They want you to not, you can't sell a car. They're car people who love cars. But I don't, and so I see them as they are. They all look the fucking same to me. It's a joke with Erin. She'll be like, "What kind of car is that?" I have no idea. I don't know. It's a car. It's a buggy. It looks stupid. They all look kind of dumb. Some of them are a little more sleek, but that's embarrassing. So the car companies know this. You can't do a commercial like, "Fuck it, just buy this car." It's like they're all the same, but ours is sort of different. So you got to add to it. You're not just buying a car. Buying safety for your family. You're going to start going outside once you get this car. Everything's going to improve with your car. But one thing they show the assholes, they've taken their fucking car to the Mojave Desert. Their marriage is now working out because of this car. They never show 5 months after you got your stupid car. There's a Diet Coke bottles laying around. ashes in the car. You don't give a shit about the car anymore. The car is nothing. So to me, bewilderment is the idea that that car is going to give you the new car feeling for the length of the lease or whatever you got into with it, instead of realizing you're going to get high on this for about 6 months, if you're lucky.
Pain of alternation.
So yes, bewilderment. Absolutely. So not.
While we're in the car, take another little drive with me. We left the theater with the guy yelling, "What the fuck was that?"
Okay.
And now we're driving home, which I was, let's say, probably 35 years ago, and was driving from Vermont to Montreal, snowing, blizzard, bad idea. The snow is now, you know how sometimes the snow will go like horizontally? It's like you don't even know which is up and which is down.
Oh,
that's kind of snow.
Terrifying.
A wiser person than me at that time would have said, all right, we're going to be late. Let's not worry about this. Let's park somewhere. But I didn't.
Yeah.
We had to be somewhere. Now we cross over into Canada, and we're on the Canadian side of the border. And I'm driving, and the wheels go into a skid, right? And I did everything right. This is the thing, you go like, okay, I screwed up. I braked fast. I didn't brake. I turned into it. I did everything right. And then nothing. And then there was a moment of like, you could say almost orgasmic release without the pleasure element of it. There was just a feeling like diving into the void, right?
Yes.
And the car went like this, and then the railing just bent the wheels up under the car, and we went down an embankment about 40 feet.
Oh, my God.
Kind of, so I'm asking, it was my wife at the time, and asking, are we okay? Did we make it out of this? But there was a moment of the glide going into the oblivion of not knowing anything and knowing that you were not knowing at that moment. It is close to the basic bewilderment. It's also close to the primordial awareness. So all I want to throw out there is that the basic bewilderment, if you don't try to stack stuff on top of it like a Chinese acrobat, you know, plates on top of it spinning, but you just go with the basic quality of it, it has already some quality of fundamental knowing and not knowing at a very primal level already in that. So then just to add another layer to it of the kind of poetry of the world, we're sitting down there, and somebody came by, and they saw us. So they came walking down, and said, "You guys all right? We can take you to a hotel, and then you can take care of your car in the morning." And they drove us back to a gas station. So guess who that was that stopped by and picked us up, but just by a total accident?
Who?
The local undertaker. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, that makes sense. He hangs out by that bad curve. That's all.
No, it was like Twilight Zone. It was just
that's fishing for him. Trust me, the guy hangs out there during snowstorms just to pick up customers. What better? Right. Find the most deadly. Was it a hearse that he had you in? Are you?
You know, it might have been his car. You know, it might have been his professional vehicle. That I don't remember. But the point, I guess, was that in that moment of glide, of losing control, which is, there are states that we enter in which we are losing control, dream, orgasm, you know, the Bardo states that we've talked about before, in which you are not driving the car anymore. But right up until then, you were driving the car. Soon after that, you'll be driving it again. But that moment is a moment of vivid bewilderment and vivid awareness simultaneously co-emerging.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, you know, the only thing I could think that happened to me recently like that is Forrest went galloping out in front of my car towards the road, and a car was coming. And yeah, I wasn't there. Like, I am not a dexterous person. I'm not athletic. But without me being involved at all, I, like, went into ninja mode and just snatched him like there was no way he could have gotten out in the street. It would have been, but it wasn't me. Like, if I'd spent a millisecond thinking about what I needed to do, it wouldn't have been great. I mean, honestly, I think the lady like saw him and brake, but still, it was like that moment of like, shit, I see what you're saying. Like, who did that? Where after the point, you're thinking, who was that? Like, where is that person all the other times I've tried to do athletic things? What was that? Who was I in that moment? Because it wasn't me.
But if you look at the layering of your mind in what you would call your ordinary state of being you, right, having the identity, I mean, we've studied this, but you can look at it. It's layered from that basic ground of kind of not knowing, or also kind of in not knowing, being very presently awake, because there's not a lot of knowing to cover up the awake. And then layering on top of that, thought after thought after thought, by the time you get to the 19th thought you had, you're way far away from that basic ground. You're not in touch with the ground of bewilderment or of awareness.
Well, okay, so this is what I want to talk to you about, is that the basic ground of awareness. Mm. I'm curious about this only because, you know, quite often it gets described as groundlessness. Mm-hmm. And yet there seems to be a quality to it that is more grounded than anything else, that it is fundamentally stable. There isn't a... in fact, it's so fundamentally stable that it, if anything, amplifies the instability. It demonstrates more how whatever the thing is in the natural world or in the world or whatever it is that you're looking for, is this is an example of this is my rock. All of those things seem like transparencies compared to it. So I think it's a little confusing in that it gets described as groundlessness.
Yeah. It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'd latch onto it in a certain way, you know, and that's the groundless part. Is there's nothing to latch onto in it and elaborate on it.
Sure.
We're used to getting comfort and security from our elaboration on that basic quality of, you know, what, not knowing or vividly not knowing, you know, not knowing yet still there's some kind of clear intelligence operating and, you know, kind of clarity of mind at the same time.
Yes.
So from that point of view, it's groundless. It's not, it's unlayered. There's nothing to grasp onto. And from the other point of view that you're talking about, it has some strange, they call it the mother and child reunion, actually, in Tantra.
No way.
Yeah. It's like the mind is coming home to some sense of space that is very familiar to us at the same time.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, you could say, you know, I played with KD last weekend up at Garrison Institute, and he got one in his talk. He said one thing about that the mantra, at a certain point, the mantra starts to feel like home, and the wandering mind feels like, you know, vacation. It reverses, you know. And I thought, yeah, that's true. The natural mind, at a certain point, it could, without all the elaboration, you could become familiar with it enough that it feels like, it feels like you've arrived at something that is stable in the way that you're talking about. In fact, there's words used for it beyond stable.
Like what?
In the great Buddhist, comedy club of all time, permanent is one word that's used.
What a bait and switch.
Oh, no kidding, man. You got to be kidding me.
That's a bait and switch, the whole bait and switch there. That's hilarious. And that's very funny, though. That is very funny.
Yeah, well, it is funny. There's other words, though, just to be fair.
Would
be, clear. There's clarity, quality. Luminous.
Sure.
There's a kind of brightness of energy around that that's unobstructed. Brilliance, or if you like, and unshakable, or some kind of feeling. It's not based on a relative, if this happened, then that would happen, then this would happen. It's just kind of stable in a certain way.
Yeah. I think that what's funny about it, and the reason I said the underground river thing, is just because I don't, and we were talking about continuity specifically, but. Because one of the words is permanence, then it would imply that regardless of how absolutely bonkers you have been, it's always been there. Even if you were fixated on this or that your whole life.
Or lifetimes.
Lifetimes. It would negate
eons.
This thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then safe. What about safe? Does that word get applied to it?
That's a tricky word. It seems more relative, at least the way it sounds to me, is like safe from what?
Death.
You can't be safe, period. You're safe from something. If a lion's chasing you, you're safe. You're safe.
I mean,
from
the
that.
Way the way Ram Dass says dying is completely safe.
Ooh, I don't know. I'd have to. We have to get him back so we can have that conversation. It's gonna
one
be hard
more
to
year. One more year.
Yeah, you know.
One more year, we're gonna have everyone back. Don't worry, AI is bringing everyone back for better or for worse. You know, actually, that, and we don't have to talk about this because I'm excited about the talk we're gonna do about it, and I don't want to ruin anything that we're gonna talk about.
And can we just mention that right now?
Yeah,
that
sure.
On May 9th, these two gentlemen, Duncan Trussell and David.
Where?
Hinton,
oh, us.
That's us. We'll be having a workshop online about AI and Dharma, basically. So we're going to not get into it tonight, but if you're able to register for that on May 9th at dharmamoon.com, you can come and hear us vet that topic. If you register, even if you can't come to the live thing, you'll be able to get the recording. So I'm looking forward to that. I think we're going to like open, you know, a kind of interesting window by talking about that. I already had some interesting thoughts about it, but we're going to wait until May 9th to do that, right?
I'm going to blow one thought, though, because this is
a teaser.
So my friend sent me some article about how, like, in a year, we're looking at a year or two, you know, digital replicas of our parents. And I got to tell you, man, I mean, I loved my mom. But for a quick second, I was like, fuck, do I really want an infinite an infinite mom? Do we really want that? It's going to be great at first. But, like, how long before I'm like, wait a minute. Can I delete my mom? Like, do I? Anyway, we'll talk about this more in our conversation. But, I think that all of the world, all the paths kind of like tinker around with this idea of coming home. Christianity, you get the prodigal son. The prodigal son goes out. One son stays home, does everything right. The other son goes and like goes to brothels and just fucks his life up, ends up becoming like a pig. I don't know what you call it. What's a pig shepherd? Is that a thing? Like he takes.
It's a good title for an album or something. I don't know. Pig shepherds. Or a band. The pig shepherds. Plural.
The pig shepherds. But he has to take care of pigs, which apparently. I don't know if there's ever been a time.
I don't know if there's a word for that. They're supposed to be so smart. I don't know if they need to be taken care of that way. They just need to be.
Farm.
You need to feed them, I think. You
keep the dirt wet, throw in slop.
Okay,
but like.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Okay.
He basically destroys his life, comes slouching back to his father's home, destroyed, and he comes to his father and says, "I'm sorry," and expecting rejection or something. And because I've looked deeply into this, I love this parable, but before he could finish his apology, his father is embracing him. So, like, he can't even keep saying, "I'm sorry." It's just instantly embraced. And then his father basically says, throws this decadent party. And his son, his other son, who's, like, out in the fields, comes back and is like, "What the fuck? Like, really? Like, you're throwing a party for this asshole? When is my party?" It's literally what he says. And his father says something along the lines of, like, "You've been alive this whole time, but that which is dead has now come back to life. That's why we're throwing the party." And so, isn't that cool? in relation to what we're talking about, is like that tantric reunion between mother and child has wrapped up in it all of the beauty of watching, you know, after a child has done some destruction. and has been scolded by the parent.
Is reabsorbed.
The hug is there. No hard feelings. Everything's fine. You know, that's a beautiful thing. And I think in relation to this thing we're talking about, if we are going to talk about this groundless ground, it's truly the most incredible thing that that's a possibility, that you get to go flopping around, become a pig shepherd out here, get lost, shoveling shit to pigs. And at any moment, if you wanted to, I think that's the in italics part of it. You kind of have to want to, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can.
Well, for example, just, you know, they say that samsara, which is sort of, we're talking, that's the part where it's sort of endless cycling through, you know, kind of stages and levels of bewilderment and confusion, and taking it for, you know, basically mistaking a rope for a snake, you know, not seeing things as they are, and just on and on with one bumble after another and one, you know, one confusion leading to the next one. They say that's endless.
Yeah.
That process is not self-relieving. So with what you're saying, there needs to be something intervening in order for the process of undoing that to get underway. Now, what that is that some kind of hitting bottom? Is that some kind of insight? Is that meeting somebody? Is that reading a book? That idea has to be introduced. And in most of the realms, it's not there. That's called the Dharma. It's just not there.
Wow.
There is nothing interrupting the hell realm, for example. Hell realms can go on for eons.
Wow. Eons. Holy shit, that's terrifying.
Yeah. But that's why there's a Buddha in each of the realms. The Buddha is not a person in that case. It's a sort of intelligence. In each realm, there's some kind of intelligence that's saying it's possible, even in this context, to recognize the nature of the experience as being causal. You know, one thing is causing the next thing, is causing the next thing, is causing the next thing. And the way to interrupt it is by recognizing the gap.
Right.
That's every realm has a gap.
See, I think that's the key word here is recognition. Recognition.
Yeah.
Like in versus like discovery. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's being able to like identify the thing to like really like know the difference between a cannon and a bird tweeting, you know, to understand those two differences, I think. And then having feedback from people like you, you know, like I think that you do require, like, there does need to be a community around it or something. I mean, I think it would be very difficult, but not impossible, minus a community. I mean, but I think the community aspect of it is where it really, where you really need that to like, not just, to be like, what the, was that a fucking cannon I just heard? You know, but also to the other experience of, I don't hear the cannon anymore. What happened to the cannon?
Well, but you're iterating the three jewels, you know, that's Sangha.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that easy to recognize. Also, you're saying recognize is a big word. It's the right word, actually, for mindfulness. And the word in Sanskrit is smirti, which the vowel police have attacked because there's not enough vowels in that word. It's like SMR. Come on, give me a break. Give me a vowel. Can I get a vowel? Yeah. And it means recollection or recognition.
Yeah.
You're remembering something, which is the quality of being, that you're noticing that you're distracted, and the quality of kind of simply returning. And you know, I think people make, you can miss it by making too big a deal about it. That's why I call it ordinary mind, too. You know, it's just not that big a deal.
Now, you know, I would say the ordinary mind thing is problematic in that I feel like when people hear that initially, at least, well, I always say this, people. I don't know why I can't say how I feel. When I...
My friend, a very good friend of mine said...
This dude with one ball and a fucking weird beard.
A dude with one ball. It's like,
there's a guy I know with one ball. He heard that, and found it off-putting in the sense.
I hope it didn't off-put the other ball. That's all I've got to say about it. Yeah.
Off-putting in the sense. Yeah, that's how he lost his ball, man. It's off-putting in the sense that in the world, we equate ordinary with not good, with mundane.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
yeah, that's right. Dull.
Dull. So when you hear, well, here's some goal or whatever, it was very ordinary, you will be like, well, why the fuck do I want that? I need a fireworks show. I want high fidelity. I want something wild, man.
Yeah.
You know, or like, you know, sometimes Forrest will say to me, I want to go somewhere new. You know, you hear it and you're like, you're put off by it a little bit, maybe, because it makes it sound like you're going to be in a DMV waiting area or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true. The language is very particular in that way, and you want to adapt the language to who you're talking to. So, you know, and you know how people, they're speaking in a foreign country or to somebody who does not speak English, and they just start talking louder.
Yes.
That's not that smart, you know what I mean? That's not the problem. So we do that in a lot of different ways, probably, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, what could be more ordinary than that? And what's interesting about that, though, is that somehow in that descriptor is an implication that actually the samsaric world, or the world of getting like all up in your head and immersed in the stories, is extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
That we, in fact, what if you're just living in a normal sort of life of suffering, that's extraordinary that you have gotten into that situation. That's an extraordinary situation to be in if the reality is that you're, as much as anything else, part of this very ordinary, groundless state. We're going to cut to a quick break.
Yeah, and ordinary has a deflating quality that in this case is appropriate to go with that meaning. It's untrumped up. It's not exceptional. There's nothing to be chased down. There's nothing to be hunted after. So really, probably most people, most of us, could arrive at it out of disappointment, out of letting go, rather than achieving some kind of high, you know? So
right.
This is very tricky because, you know, the engine of samsara is basically the notion that you could add something to the situation that will complete it.
Yeah, right. Like this thing we're talking about, there's nowhere to hang your diploma. Like, otherwise it'd be covered. Like and I think that's kind of one of the, when they talk about liberation or you know, Thurman will talk about revolution. In a way, you could say it's revolutionary only in the sense that it's inaccessible to target. Like, it's inaccessible to branding. It's inaccessible to anybody who wants to lay claim to it or make it theirs. This is my groundless state of emptiness, or welcome to the Starbucks tent in the realm of emptiness. It's in that way, there's a truly liberating quality to it if you've gotten sick of like being constantly drawn into infinite scams, generally self-perpetuated scams, but
infinite self-perpetuated scam world.
Yeah, infinite self-perpetuating scam world. Eventually that gets, you get so sick of it.
That's literally what they say is, there's, when I first learned that word renunciation, which is part of the Buddhist path, is the actual, it's in, I believe in Tibetan, it's like something like Chinook. And it sounds a lot like schnook, but
yeah,
it's
exactly
amazing. Like that.
Chinook.
But it means nauseated.
Yeah.
And that feeling, you know, when you are about to, when you get nauseous, it's like a feeling you just can't abide it anymore. You can't hold it down anymore. And that's what they say is the renunciation is recognizing that quality in samsara, is that you've been there long enough, you've done it long enough. You've been up and down long enough. You've been disappointed long enough. You've been exhilarated long enough. And, you know, beginning to look for maybe something more stable quality, you know.
Yeah.
And then in looking for that, you can't find anything solid to hold on to there either. So you get a chance to feel the groundlessness, you know, there before you would touch the ground of that open space, you know.
You know, that's a, you know, do you get into Jean-Paul Sartre at all, or like
As an English major at Columbia College, I did.
You know, that's his most famous book, right? Nausea, yeah. The description of. Mm-hmm. That's what he called it. Like, he identified it that way too. Just like,
wow.
And people hear that, and I think with him, you could argue he was quite pessimistic in a certain way. But, you know, people hear all this stuff and they feel like it sounds so pessimistic.
Mm.
It sounds, you know, oh, really? You're going to call this nauseating? Are you kidding? Have you seen the new season of Succession? It's incredible. That episode made me cry. How dare you call this nauseating? I had a wonderful time in Costa Rica. Nauseating? Why would you say that? That wasn't nauseating. Well, you Buddhists are so fucking bitter. And that, to me, I think that's where it gets really interesting, is that in a lot of the descriptors, you're not hearing a critique of the world or of life or a rejection of life as much as like a big sigh of relief from people who are like, oh fuck, that was nauseating. Like, you know, you go to, when you get off the roller coaster, you know, and you're sick, and then finally that nausea dissipates. What's a better feeling than when finally, oh my god, oh, that was fucking nauseating. So I think sometimes in these descriptors you're getting,
yeah,
you're confusing some. It gets confusing,
sure,
for people. It an off-putting. It maybe even has the opposite effect.
Sure. Well, you know, it could be that often Buddhism's the last stop on the train. Like you're riding around on the train, and you know, somewhere deep in the bowels of Brooklyn, it just, the train stops. There are no more stops, no more options, and you're just kind of sitting there. Unfortunately, that's sort of the Buddhist stop in a way. It doesn't offer more entertainment, and you know, it can be presented that way, and there is certainly a magnetic dimension to having given up and given in that much, so that you're not grasping at phenomena anymore as a solution to a basic underlying problem of what is my identity. So I'll grasp at more phenomena in order to stabilize my sense of identity, and so there is a kind of definite desolation to it. That's been spoken about quite a lot by different teachers. And then there is, you know, there are kind of things about it that can be presented in a magnetic way. And probably the role of a teacher is to be not desolate the way you're talking about all the time.
Well, you're
not. For example,
not.
It's the ultimate sense of humor is at that last stop in the bowels of Brooklyn. You want to get some funny jokes, that's where you're going to get them.
Right. Yeah, well, right? I mean, there is something innately funny about it. I mean, it actually is there is something within it that is incredibly comedic, but only because, like, it's not so goddamn funny when you haven't caught quite a glimpse of it. It's not funny at all. That's a tragedy. That is not a comedy. That's hell. Yeah. That's a tragedy. It's just what you're talking about. But you catch that glimpse of the thing, and then suddenly, yeah, it can become comedic or romantic or just poignant. It can become quite poignant. I get that. I think that the mother and child reunion thing, that's a good way to describe. Like, I think of when you come home from college. You know, you're at college, you're on acid, you're banging girls with hairy legs, and you're I'm sorry, I said banging. You're making love to girls. You're making love to girls with hairy legs, and you, I don't think I've ever banged a day in my life. I don't even know if you call it making love. It's more of like a quick pop than a bang. I think.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't have to get into details about that, but you know, you come home, and you've gotten your college, you've convinced yourself you're Dostoevsky or some shit, and then, you know, you come home. And there's something incredibly boring about that. You're not looking forward to it even, maybe. You're like, oh, fuck, gotta go home. This is, here we go, back to home. But then you get home, and your mom's in the driveway. My mom would come out in the driveway, and she hugs you.
Oh.
And, you know, and you smell your house, and you get this something you just can't get. You're not going to get anywhere else. And so I think that is a perfect descriptor. It's like, except at home, you're not Dostoevsky anymore. You know, you're the kid who's, you're still you. You're the person whose diapers were changed and who went through all the various phases that you were seen for, and that you're just you. That's, you don't get the same. If you've managed to like stir up some controversy about you in college or wherever you are, getting off on that narcissistic twist that you've learned, you won't get that kind of, generally you don't get rewarded for that at home. There isn't that. So it's mundane. Mm. It's boring. But it's the best thing ever.
People, it's harder to bullshit people because they know you pretty well.
No more bullshit.
Your mother is extraordinary. Your mother, let's just take a moment and just bow deeply at the feet of your mother.
Thank you.
What an extraordinary person. That the communication you had with her is not to be taken for granted, you know. Most people don't have it.
No, I got lucky with that one.
And you got to share it with people like us, you know, who go, wow, that was some conversation there that you had. And for people who don't know what I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about the last episode of the Midnight Gospel, in which you are sharing your heart and mind with your mother in the most vulnerable moment possible, which is her beginning to leave the world. And boy, it left a big imprint on me, and I'm sure other people too.
Thanks.
It's just it's worth appreciating that for a minute. Like, wow.
You know, mothers get short shrift in our society. You know, in the same way that like the what you're talking about, the primordial awareness gets short shrift. It's in fact, you could almost say it's like an identical discarding of the damn thing. You know what I mean? Like here is this thing that is completely there for you, always there. And even, and I mean mother archetype, I know some of us don't have that kind of mom, or right now you don't have that kind of mom, but you know what I mean, but it's so there, and it's so
well, and you're right, if you don't have it from your physiological mother, doesn't diminish the principle of it. Because somewhere in this world there is that bank of energy that is nurturing, supportive, unchanging in terms of not fickle, in terms of affection. And everybody has a right to find a place like that, even if it's a friend or a counselor or a dog.
Sure.
A lot of people have that with their dog.
Yeah. I do think it's like the first trick that the world wants to play on you is to get you to forget about your mom, to forget about that quality, the what you came from, all of it. It's the first trick. And in fact, in horror movies, my friend was telling me he took a seminar on writing horror scripts, and that in horror movies, a repeating pattern in horror movies is you can't talk to your mom anymore. So, when was the last time you saw Alien?
Oh, I've seen that.
Do you remember what the name of the ship was?
I forgot.
Mother.
Oh, right. Okay.
And losing contact with Mother.
Holy mackerel. Wow.
Yeah, it's really, so that plays into like the deepest primordial.
Well, and then it goes deeper than that because the most ferocious alien is the Mother, right?
What? Which one?
In the Aliens, the one who she has the most endless battle with is the mother of the aliens.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, right. You get the...
So they, even from that perspective of, like, what you think is hostile and aggressive, they've got a mother.
Spewing
acid and, you know, protecting them.
Don't fuck with mothers. I mean, you really shouldn't. I mean, this is a... again, like, I don't care what the animal is. So you find a chipmunk, Try to fuck with the chipmunk's babies. Watch that chipmunk. The chipmunk will become so wrathful. I mean, we don't picture chipmunks as wrathful, and honestly, I'm just freeballing. Freeballing, is that a thing? But I'm guessing.
Spitballing, I think, is what they call it.
Not freeballing. Spitballing. Yeah. Freeballing is very different. Right. If you stick your finger into a chipmunk's nest where there's babies, you're going to bring back a bloody finger. The chipmunk isn't thinking it's a giant doing this. And so in the description of mothers, which is what I love about Eastern traditions, is they really cover all the angles of the mama. You know, right. it's not mm-hmm. just the loving, embraceful mm-hmm. mother.
Right.
It's the wrathful, protective mother. It's the mother that's scolding you, mother. I was just talking to my friend about this. It's the sexy mother.
Right.
You know, the whole picture gets covered. So I think if we're going to say this groundless primordial awareness state is a mother and child reunion situation, would you argue that within that primordial emptiness, those qualities somehow still exist?
Do they exist in it as embedded as potentiality? Without a doubt, they're unmanifested at that level, but then they very quickly manifest, arise from it, and take those forms that you're talking about and dissolve back into the bigger, you know, the space. So there is, I think, a space that's beyond what you're talking about, that's non-dual in nature, and but it's very potent, and for it to express itself even slightly, it has to manifest as in polarity,
right.
Which is what I think Tantra really is about. It's not really, the practicing end of it is dual. It is polarity. It is understanding the dynamic of that. And it, you know, it's expressed as masculine and feminine. You can think of that in different ways if you need to. And you certainly don't have to associate it with the physical body of the male and the female. When you visualize the deity that's, you know, a masculine and feminine deity in union, it's just you, an individual, visualizing it, and they're inseparably interlinked, and they're both aspects of yourself. So there's no attempt to sort of, let's say, have a sociological depiction of it that that could get you down the wrong tube.
Sure.
But there is polarity, and I think that's where I balk at sometimes. The New Age or some of the traditions go, you know, they are so much drawn to the non-dual, the blended quality of reality. But really, if you look at the challenge or the energy sparking, it's really comes from polarity. Now, these days, the polarity has gotten too stiff and too tight, and it's not really dancing, you know?
How do you mean?
Well, you know, it's like, I've noticed this recently, like, all kinds of arguments are arising in which one side has a very hard left and one side has a very hard right. So it's like the stereo image is too severe.
Right.
There's not like that nice blend of like, oh, that creates a pastiche, that creates a diorama, that creates a kind of playful but powerful and challenging field of activity. It just creates warfare.
Okay, what you just said reminds me of the story Krishnadas talks about. I can't remember... It was one of the, I can't remember which Ramdas, which person it was hanging around with Neem Karoli Baba, one of Neem Karoli Baba's close associates. And Krishnadas tells a story of how they would have screaming philosophical fights in India, screaming at each other. But underneath it is just love. Like underneath it, which is my favorite kind of philosophical argument, where with someone you trust and you love, you're able to trust each other enough to get into those kinds of like absolute. One of my best friends, when we were in India, we were in a terrible argument. He flipped a table. He was like, when were you guys ever going to stop this? You know? And it was the best. And we're best friends to this day. But it was like we loved each other enough that we could go to that level with each other and know at the other side of that, we're friends. Like, it's not going anywhere. And I think what you're talking about is like people are having those screaming fights minus the love. And so,
well, and then they're shooting each other quite literally.
I mean,
it's beyond a metaphor at this point. It's like you go knocking on somebody's door and they come out with a shotgun. It's like we're in crazy town right now. I mean, a lot of people are just living some kind of like measured existence and with consequences and things like that. But I think a lot of people I know feel like the train is slipping off the rails a little bit. Do you have that feeling?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the problem is that we haven't gotten to the last stop yet, and the train is slipping off the rails. But change is terrifying. Change is terrifying. And when people are afraid, they get angry instantly. And so, today, I think we were just out during. I laughed about it because we're having this nice text about emptiness. Mm. And some motherfucker decided to do that thing where they half stick out of the turning lane instead of going all the way in the turning lane. Mm. I mean, a relatively minor offense in the world of driving, and certainly one I am very guilty of. So I think I had just responded to you with voice text, some bullshit about emptiness. This person does that. And I'm like, I laid on the horn instantly. I didn't think about it. And then I'm driving and I'm laughing because I'm like, Jesus Christ. Like, I didn't think when I did that. Like, I was looking back at that. I'm like, I'm going to teach this person a lesson, or I need to really, this person should understand the danger that they're presenting to all the, or the selfishness, or it was just pure rage.
Right.
So that, when you go out in your house and shoot somebody, or in your yard and shoot somebody, that means you have to think about the state of consciousness preceding the event. You know what I mean? That, like, you're pretty wound up, man. You're pretty fucking wound up. I'm guessing, I don't know, but I imagine that my laying on the horn moment, for them, it's shooting someone moment.
Yes, that's
you know what I mean? It's like they're not there. And then they have to, that's why they always have that weird look on their face after they've done it.
Yeah.
Is they're trying to work out in their mind how they managed to shoot somebody for going in their yard. You know, and so that, I think the reason you're going to see upticks and upticks, I think you could just predict the more terrified people to become, the more you can expect violence. The more completely freaked out people become, the more you, and then that creates the feedback loop, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because the more violence, the more terrified people become. And there's the Kali Yuga, right? That's the idea. Yeah. Like,
and the flip side of it is, I don't, you know, it's all terrible. But when I saw that young teenage boy who just went to the wrong address by mistake to pick up his brother and sister, and all you have to do to really connect is think, what if that was my son?
Yeah.
Everybody could just for a minute put it all down and think, however this happened, what if that was my son? He went to the wrong address to pick up his brother or sister, and innocently, and somebody shot them. How would you feel? That's all you need to know.
I mean,
you need to know that it could be your son, and then or your daughter, and then you're going to have a different attitude towards it.
Let's stretch it out to even more blasphemous terrain. Think of all the sons and daughters who were engaged in shit they shouldn't have been engaged in and got shot for it. Does that make it any better? I mean, is anything here good? Like, does it make it, but like, you know, everyone's like, and I, you know, of course, like, it's a fucking tragedy that happens by accident and seems to be happening over and over. But anytime it happens, for whatever reason, I mean, think of like the pregnant woman who was shoplifting at Walgreens or whatever and got shot. Like, does that somehow make it a softer blow that somebody thought that was the right decision in that moment? No. Like, think of the justified war. You know, the you know, like, so does that make it better when we're watching like Russian soldiers get exploded by drones? Is suddenly that great when we're seeing someone in their last moments looking desperately up at the sky knowing they're about to die? No matter what the fact that this is where we've come to in our ability to have conversations regarding property, safety, justice, is that this is the resort, just some brutish, stupid violence? No, like, all of it across the board is indicative of a massive amount of terror in the zeitgeist right now, a massive amount of fear, a massive amount of confusion. You know, I'm not, that's not to say that when things are calmer, this shit doesn't happen, but
and again,
I'm only speaking from my own personal experience with rage. It's
well, and going back to our the earlier part of our pre-conversation here, before we started recording this, just hello everybody out there. Let's just join in wishing Duncan a happy birthday today. It's his birthday.
Thank you.
And April 20th.
Yeah.
And is it okay to say how old you are? Do you mind?
Yeah, I don't mind.
Okay, so 49, which is a big birthday because of the seven sevens and
what? I got seven sevens? I didn't even think of that. God, that explains why I'm feeling so good lately.
It's a big cycle moment. They say you know, at that point you can start spiraling up or spiraling down in terms of karmically, you know. But that's a little esoteric thing. And
it's
then,
funny you should say that, because my friend for my birthday gave me heroin and a heroin needle. And right after we have this conversation, I was going to shoot up for the first time.
Well, that would be hopefully...
That's an up spiral.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. That's a bad joke. I'm sorry, David.
But, and here to make matters worse, what we shared is that it's also Adolf Hitler's birthday.
God damn it.
So how's that for co-emergence, that you, the angel of light that you are, and well-being, have share the same origin point, birth point, as probably one of the more obvious demonic manifestations in the history of our memory.
It's very annoying because we also, and again, I don't know why I'm making this podcast so freaking testicular, but apparently... Apparently Adolf Hitler only had one ball.
No.
So we don't just share birthdays.
Oh, and is that true?
I've looked it up, and it's sort of like, we don't know if that was propaganda or if that's real. You know,
is it the same ball?
I don't know. I've never seen Adolf Hitler's balls. I don't think there's a picture of them
there. Nobody knows which ball he didn't have?
How weird would it be if he trimmed his bush with the same stupid mustache right above his junk? Oh.
Adolf.
Yeah, Adolf, 420, Columbine. It's a real, like, it's a mixed birthday to have, because there's all kinds of, shitty things that happen around. I think Oklahoma City bombing right around now.
We got to own him. We got to own him because... I'm Jewish, you know. This is a big deal for me. Big, big deal.
Well,
goes
we can
back.
Still be
People
friends.
Talk about, you know, challenging traumatic experiences. You know, this is a big, big, as big as it gets in my personal psyche. But, you know, we can't say he's another species from another planet. We can't really say that. He's one of us, and he went that way, and a lot of people followed. That's something to be really, really aware of.
Yeah.
Nobody like that could do it on their own. Impossible.
No.
So we all have some of that, you know, whatever that energy is of wanting so hard to be right. I mean, it's sort of trivializing what that is all about, but at some level, it's the opposite of the mother and child reunion.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, it's a just a classic, like.
It's the child killing the mother.
Yeah, it's the
matricide.
What's the story? There's the famous philosopher. I can't remember his name. It doesn't matter. Yet another famous Greek philosopher. He was renowned. And I think it was Caesar. Takes out his whole troop, his whole entourage of golden chariots, all the bullshit, to go see this philosopher who I think was living next to a river. I think it was Diogenes, maybe. I'm not sure, but living next to a river, eating out of a... I think he ate out of a dog bowl. And so Caesar comes and is standing before him and says to him, I will give you anything you want. And apparently this philosopher, I think Diogenes, says, could you move a little to the right? You're blocking my light. Because he was standing... Ultimate burn! Ultimate emperor burn! Roasted! Like, brutalized by this philosopher who's like, get the fuck, you're not buying me, motherfucker. Get out of here. This is, we have
is that
this.
True? Is that
yeah,
a true story?
Look it up. It was the ultimate just refutation. The Similar story when, you know, they try to trap Jesus by asking if should we pay taxes.
Right.
And he said, show me a coin. And whose face is on that coin? Caesar. And he said, give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's.
Oh, and it was that specific. Okay.
Another slap in the face, which is like, yeah, take your stupid discs. You can have all of them. Take your little metal discs. You can have as many as you fucking want.
Oh, God.
You know, but the enlightened ones, they're always doing that to power. And Hitler obviously is an example of someone trying to be the sun, trying to be God, trying to be the sum total of everything. And
sure.
and that what sucks is, you know, the sun doesn't wear cool outfits, you know, so people get confused by it. The what we're talking about, which I think you could argue is a kind of sun, primordial awareness. You know,
sun
what I
mean? Is good. Yeah, even sun burns out faster than primordial awareness does, though.
Yes, right.
It's that kind of notion of time is embedded there.
So the Hitler situation, I think, would be a person trying to trick people into thinking they're primordial awareness, or they're the sun, or they're in creating a completely unnecessary intermediary, right? That's the issue.
And religions are famous for doing that too, creating that intermediary, and the intermediary by mistake, or, you know, collusion or whatever happens, tries to lay claim to the primordial.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's
and
it.
Then in desperation you go, well, okay, you are my source for the primordial. But that's like a very subtle point that, you know, you can have very potent and strong teachers who are smart and learned and, you know, deeply trained, but they don't own the primordial. That's a mistake.
Yeah.
They don't
right.
own that access. They don't have
you can't package it.
No, they point to it.
Yeah, they point to it, but don't. Yeah, and I think that's where it gets interesting. Is like, I think, I don't know for sure about this, but I don't think there has to be any particular ethical, moral, component to like, to recognize that thing that we're talking about. You can recognize it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're in that recognition. You're necessarily going to be making great decisions all the time, especially if you just catch a glimpse of it, right?
That's a super important point there. It's almost like a whole nother podcast, but just to catch a glimpse of that. Yeah, if you're catching glimpses of it, it means it's not stabilized as your reference point, so therefore you're flickering, it's flickering on and off, and all kinds of things are going to happen. But if it's somewhat stable and the person has a kind of groundlessness, you're right, that does not equate necessarily to the development of skillful means in action. That could be a separate learning curve.
I know we only have a little bit more time here, but, you know, I don't know why. I know why I'm doing it now, because I'm reading this great Charles Manson book, but I started watching Charles Manson videos again.
Wow.
And what I think was so incredibly confusing about him is, I think when you see him, you do see someone who seems to have caught a glimpse of this thing. You do see someone who's not faking it. You do see someone who's like really in the moment, and someone who's like really just right there. And yet not all like completely violent, completely power hungry, completely wanting to be the sun. I mean, his name was literally Man's Son, like wanting to like be the sum total, even though it's a different spelling of sun, obviously. But you know what I'm saying is, like, this is a big, I think people, this is where people get really in trouble, is because,
well, and it's a notion of Rudrahood. Rudra, the tantra student who killed his teacher and became a kind of, because once there's a certain amount of understanding, or even siddhis, even little, you know, talents and powers that manifest because the person is kind of strongly moving towards some kind of wakeful situation. At that glitch where they begin to freeze that up and kind of like see it as a power struggle, that's the most dangerous people that you have on the spiritual path, actually.
Yeah.
And there's warnings about becoming that is the biggest warning I got. and you know, how to deal with it. So it's not, you know, it's not saying don't go for it, you know, but it's saying there has to be a system of checks and balances, which is usually the teacher. And that's why when Rudra killed his own teacher, he removed the system of checks and balances. That he, there was no longer anybody who could tell him he was wrong.
Right. He got rid of the one, like, last, right, like, thing that was protecting him. And then, fuck, you're fucked. Like, maybe this is why in some traditions, like Kabbalah or whatever, they say you can't study this until you get to a certain age. And the reason is because, you know, by the time you get to be my age, you're too exhausted to run a cult. You know what I mean? You're so fucking tired. You're not going to, like, you know what I mean? The odds of you getting all mansoned out by the glimpse or something like that. You're just like, you just want a nap. Yeah, you want to roll.
A pina colada.
You want a fucking pina colada, not a chalice of LSD surrounded by filthy hippie girls humping each other. That sounds the opposite of fun to you when you get to my age.
You're so old already. You're only 49 today, and look at how.
Well, I got kids, so it's like the whole orgy thing kind of goes out the window when you know what I mean. Like your priorities shift. You know, you just want to get home from dinner in time to watch a show and go to sleep, you know? So that's, and I like that.
Yeah.
Like I find that to be really wonderful. It was not fun in the days of hungering for orgies and chalices of acid. I mean, it was fun, but not the same kind of fun.
Well, you know, what's happening is you're sort of fully
getting boring.
You're literally moving into the human realm.
Right,
which it's hard to see it, but it's not one of the liberations. It's another realm, but it has this. It has a possibility because there's not so much confidence or desolation. There's something between the two,
right?
Which makes you a little more vulnerable to seeing the nature of the experience as it is, but it's also a trap.
Great, another fucking Buddhist trap.
I mean, you know, Buddha was in the human realm, and then he had to go out and do a whole lot of practice, you know.
Look, I'll take human realm. It's a pretty great place. I mean,
well, it's the only place, according to Buddhism, that you can really have the conversation we're having right now.
Right. Like,
that's the only place. If we're jealous gods, we can't have this conversation. If we're in hell realm, we can't have it.
Yeah. If like Brian Wilson is, like, if you're kissing Brian Wilson's feet or whatever your filthy ass is doing, you know what I mean? Like, it's... What's going on here? What are you up to here, Manson? Mm. Didn't anyone just take him aside and say, "What's going on here, man? Ooh. What are you doing? What's your plan?" I guess if you did that, he'd be like, "What is my plan? You are my plan. Mm. You make my plan my plan." There's some bullshit.
Well, you know, even in nature, there are poisonous spiders, deadly poisonous snakes. You know, not every creature is meant to be, handled with a kind of innocence and naivete as you connect with them.
Yeah, and I think the reason I get attracted to that story is because I recognize in me someone who would be like talking to a friend and be like, "You got to meet this guy I met. He is so fucking cool. His name's Charles Manson. He's got a ranch not far away. Let's go up there. If at the very least he's got like cute girls around him, good acid." Like, I could just see me getting completely pulled in to that daddy figure that he was. You know, he played the daddy role or the like.
But he was never an actual father, though.
Oh, Manson, yes, he was.
He had children?
Yeah, Manson had. Yeah, you think he didn't have kids? He had a lot of kids.
I don't know.
He just didn't raise them.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, David, this is a different podcast. We have a few minutes. But I'll send you. The funniest thing was there was this dude in L.A. claiming to be Manson's son and having some band like that was like based on the theme that he was Manson's son. And then I think a paternity test. They he got pressured into doing a paternity test. And he was not the son of Charles. In fact, I think Manson's kids intentionally that's not the first thing you're going to put on your resume. They intentionally avoid identifying him as their dad, you know.
Well, in honor of all the potentially misguided and, you know, kind of badly constructed human beings who've caused so much harm to others, and recognizing that we all have the potential to manifest that or manifest some kind of wise wisdom and compassion, and that takes intention, it takes effort. In that spirit, you know, we can recognize that without eschewing it and thinking it's not part of our ecosystem.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It should be recognized, and that's why I think the dark side has to be kind of the shadow aspect has got to be worked with in your spiritual practice.
Yeah.
It can't be just brushed under the rug, and it doesn't have to be glorified. But I think we just got to bring awareness to the whole damn thing. You know, who are we?
I agree, David. I think that's a really sad thing when you don't want to just recognize that little Charlie Manson living in your heart.
Let alone Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, they're all hanging out in there having a horrible, horrible time. David, let's remind folks, everyone, I'm very excited about this. You know, if you listen to this podcast at all, you know I'm obsessed with AI, and I love Buddhism, and the idea of having a chance to sort of philosophically have a philosophical conversation with David about where the Dharma and AI meet, or what the future might hold for us regarding Buddhism in the era of AI, or spirituality in the era of AI. I think these are just interesting and important things that we should be exploring as we push the accelerator towards the singularity. So I'm excited about this. Will you tell everybody when it is again, David?
Okay, so that's going to be on May 9th, coming up. And it's going to be a 90-minute workshop, and it's going to be combined with, so you can, we'll put the link in your text scroll attached to this podcast so people know how to do it. But otherwise, you can just go to dharmamoon.com.
Great.
D-H-A-R-M-A. moon.com, and it's also going to have a short info session as part of it for our upcoming 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training program, which starts June 23rd. And so we'll also be just talking a little bit about that and how people can check that out if they want to. So those two events are connected.
Is there a fee for it? I can't remember.
No. So great. That's good. Thank you. That's very good to mention. It's free.
Right.
You know, so that just removed your final, obstacle to attending. And you can also register for it. And then if you're not available during the real time that it's happening, you'll get the recordings automatically in your email the next
Beautiful.
Day.
Beautiful. Great.
So that's that's for that session. And then that pre-shadows the entrance into the 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training, which you can also learn about at the website. We'll put a link for that in the text. And you know, I gotta say, Duncan, we have one going on right now which has at least 20 or 25 people who love you dearly, who are, you know, kind of
wonderful,
have come into this situation through following you and your podcast and our conversation. So it's really gotten to be a kind of family kind of energetic to it. And I say it every time, but I like to acknowledge those kind of things every time. It's a good thing. There's a lot of people who are following you, who are watching how you explore things and kind of getting a sense of humor from it, a sense of intelligence from it, then they start to explore their world in the same way that you've been exploring yours, and it's a good thing.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad. That's good. Anybody who like gets connected with you and Dharma Moon, that makes me happy, because it certainly has had a positive effect on my life. And I can't wait for our talk.
Yeah.
I'm so excited about it. I'll try to, maybe I'll see if I can like whip up some AI stuff that we could show or something
cool
like that. So people can kind of see where it's at. David, until next time, thank you so much. And I'll see you real soon in May.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Okay. Bye, Duncan.
Bye. Big thank you to David for joining us on the show. Again, all the links to our AI talk that's coming up, along with the teacher training and everything David Nickturn, will be at DuncanTrussell.com. You can just look at the section of the website where this podcast lives. Thank you to our wonderful sponsors, Lumi Labs. Thank you to Athletic Greens. The combination of these two things will turn you into a titan. And thank you for listening. Come see me, Charlie Goodnight's Helium. Those links are at DougAtrussell.com. I'll see you next week. Love you. Bye.